make it through to you. Byron doesn't answer, which just makes me fume. Why do you care anyway? I challenge. I guess I just thought we had something, Wisty, he says quietly, his pride clearly wounded. Oh, that. We're talking about life and death here, Byron, and you're telling me you're jealous? Byron's face immediately shuts down, and he strides over to the shelves, grabbing armfuls of stun devices, ropes, and a megaphone for the next round of drills. I keep my distance on the other side of the small room, watching his agitated, jerky movements with guilt. I don't want to hurt Byron, but I don't want to like him either. That intense connection we had playing on stage together at the Stockwood Music Festival frankly still freaks me out. Byron, don't take it personally. I just... Whatever, he says, back to his clipped New Order demeanor. He turns to go. Hey, I call after him. Just get me in the palace, okay? I'll see what I can do, he says, noncommittally. Then he turns back around. And Wisty? Byron's face looks suddenly grave, and dread settles in the pit of my stomach. What? My voice sounds high and thin. He chews his lip as if deciding something, and I almost shake him. You need to work fast. My intel says Wit's in serious trouble in the Shadowland. You don't have much time to deal with the One if you want to save him.
Chapter 52. Torches bob, blurry in my peripheral vision. A bonfire belches into the blood-red twilight. Fire is all around us, licking at our skin and lighting our expressions of terror, and the stench of the gathering lost ones, of their rotting flesh and dark intentions, is truly unbearable. The shrill intensity of their chants builds in tune with my racing heart. My arms ache from the weight of my body, and I flinch away from the hands of death that reach for me. I'm strung up high on some massive wheel, an ancient torture device that keeps my arms and legs spread wide, my body exposed, so that these putrid creatures can spin me around, touch me, and be healed. Below me, the stage is set for an ominous holiday feast, and the resistance kids are bound on their circle of spits. Sasha shouts fight anthems mixed with obscenities at the lost ones, in a never-ending babble of protest, and Emmett looks heartbreakingly sad, but determined not to make a scene. If the resistance is going down, it's going down with honor, if he has anything to say about it. Most of the other kids are sobbing uncontrollably, but Janine is resigned, her strong face a mask. She won't meet my eyes. Hands cover me, and the ancient wheel turns, spinning me left, then right, so I have to strain my neck to see anything. My heart longs to fight, to keep fighting until my last breath, but I'm so weak and dizzy, and there are so many of them, rabid with need. How can this be the end of everything? Some child of the prophecy I've turned out to be. The lost ones stamp the ground, growing impatient. The awful chanting reaches a fever pitch, the ravenous howls slicing into the evening. But the youngest child's screams drown out all else as they drag him toward the pit to be roasted alive. We're done for.
Chapter 53. Well, I have to hand it to Byron. I asked, and he delivered. I got exactly what I wanted. A cleaning position in the elite apartments of the palace compound. But somehow I'm not quite as happy scrubbing toilets as I thought I'd be. The compound is a solid brick building, part fortress, part palace, and it takes me 2 days of entering through the heavily guarded gates, passing under the metal detectors, and waiting in the steel-sealed holding cell before a fellow worker loans me a key to go through the side entrance that leads straight to the elite complex. The high-ceilinged, echoing corridors are exactly what you'd expect from the New Order, with clean linoleum floors and ultra-sanitary surfaces. The private apartments, on the other hand, are an entirely different story. The upper echelons of our society may be a buttoned-up bunch, but they're not always the most hygienic in their personal quarters. Take it from one who knows. Be careful what you influence for, I guess. But it all pays off in the end, because after scouring, sanitizing, and polishing my 15th toilet, I'm assigned the proverbial pot of gold, his personal lavatory. I stand in the doorway for at least 10 minutes, listening. This is my chance to find some weakness, some vulnerability, to riffle through the one's most private, hidden items. But at first, I can't even move for fear of being caught. The one's apartment is shockingly spare, almost sterile. There's hardly any furniture, and what's here is a simple, sturdy black. The claustrophobic red paint vibrating on the wall is as crimson as a crime scene or an open wound. The only things of note are the mirrors, gold-framed, one on each wall. They're presumably so his baldness will always have a place to gaze adoringly at himself, but somehow they give a person the feeling that he's looking out of them, watching, instead of looking in. A narrow bed is the only item in the windowless bedroom. I reach out to it tentatively, as if it's a sleeping monster, ready to snap off my hand. Though it looks hard, it's surprisingly soft, giving under my touch. Are the sheets warm, or is it my imagination? It's impossible to imagine him sleeping here, or sleeping at all. The floor creaks below my feet, and my heart leaps out of my chest. I strain to listen for a hint of voices approaching, but all I can hear is the blood surging in my ears. I search the corners for hidden cameras and expect to trip a booby trap with every movement. I've never been so jumpy in my life. I know I have to buck up, get it together, do what I came here to do, but all I keep thinking is, the one tortures kids for minor infractions and curses thousands of people with bleeding open sores. What kind of horrors awaits a staff member caught snooping in his most personal items? In the bathroom mirror, gold-framed enormous, a lost-looking, frightened girl stares back at me, threatening to bolt. But I see my parents' faces there too, pleading and hopeful. I splash my face in the ice-cold water of the stainless steel sink, swallow my fear, and carefully open a cupboard. It's strange. You don't think of evil people having personal things, and it's impossible to imagine what the one might have stored in these bathroom drawers, what ghastly souvenirs from a lifetime of cruelty. But the items I do find, including dentures and Technicolor contact lenses, are bizarrely mundane and almost funny in the way they suggest self-consciousness. I'm pawing through these ordinary articles, fascinated, when a floorboard creaks in the hallway. I don't dare breathe as the footsteps get louder, louder, almost upon me, and then echo down the hall toward the other apartments. I sigh, turning back to my task. Peering into the cupboard again, I notice a tiny box that I somehow missed before, and inside it, a silver key. It seems impossible that I could locate what door or safe this small key unlocks, but I remember a desk by the entryway, and when I walk across the apartment and slide the key into the hole in the drawer, it turns with a satisfying click. When they say, too easy, this is what they mean. Inside, there's an odd collection of mementos. None of them mind-blowing, but apparently important to the one nonetheless. They're special, personal. Human, as hard to believe as it seems. There's an award for extraordinary abilities in a science contest, a picture of a young and smiling one with a small girl, possibly a sister, and a certificate of artistic appreciation recognizing young talent. Buried farther down, I also find a report of difficulties in social development, a handwritten note from a teacher about disturbing demonstrations that frightened other students, and a letter of expulsion. I want to keep digging, want to find more about the boy who would grow up to be the greediest, most powerful being in the overworld, but time is running out, and I haven't even cleaned anything yet. I carefully replace all the documents, But as I start to close the drawer, I glimpse the yellowed edge of a photograph caught in the side. I bite my lip, checking my watch. It's a risk, but one last look couldn't hurt. It takes me several minutes to work the picture out of the crack it's jammed in, and when I do, I draw a sharp intake of breath. I lean against the desk, mesmerized. It appears to be another family photograph. This one is taken from farther away, when the one was a bit older but still a boy. There's an older man in the picture, with jutting cheekbones and an upright posture. The man is smiling, wide but strangely lacking emotion, as if the grin is taped on. The man's hand is on the boy's shoulder, near his neck, gripping at the kid's clothing and pressing him forward for the pose, gripping hard. The boy in the picture, the one, which is still weird to think about, is not smiling, at all. His eyes are different than in the earlier photo with the young girl, too. They understand more. Those eyes have seen terrible things. And here's the part that's most chilling. The older man's eyes and nose have been scratched out with a black pen so that a skeleton seems to peer back at me, its grotesque grin hiding all of its secrets. Hands shaking, I shove the photo back into the crack and then hastily scrub the already sparkling toilet. I slink out of the apartment, my mind whirring with the knowledge that the one was once a kid, once had friends and family, once smiled and ached and felt things, rejection among them, and once had a father whose smile was not a smile at all. I'm so caught up in my thoughts that I don't even see his coldness coming down the hallway until I nearly walk smack into him. Chapter 54. The carpet in the elite complex corridor is blood red, with a swirling, repeating O pattern that is making me dizzy and nauseous. My work shoes, once bleach white and spotless, are grimy and disgusting. I stand slightly pigeon-toed, a fact that's never annoyed me until now. I know I probably shouldn't be so preoccupied with the minute details of my feet. I came here to deal with him, to use my power, to rid the world of this evil. But the truth is, I'm utterly petrified to look up at the one. Has the air around him always been so freezing? Has he always seemed so tall and menacing? Does he always wear those dark suits so perfectly pressed? Could he always suck the air right out of my lungs? He's so cold, so evil, and he waits me out silently, his tall figure unmoving. I think it'll go on like this forever, until he finally breaks the spell with his calm, patronizing voice. Don't be afraid, child. You should be proud of yourself for achieving such an important post at a young age. Many New Order youth will never experience the great honor of entering my private quarters, let alone tending my toilet. I can't believe what I'm hearing. Achieving an important post? Cleaning toilets? Nothing about destroying me, or using my gift, or being an utter disappointment? Before I can squeak out a response, the one turns on his heel and strides away, carefree, whistling the NO's national anthem as he enters his apartment. I let out a long, uneasy sigh. I hadn't realized I'd been holding my breath. Should I feel relieved that he didn't recognize me, or am I really that forgettable? Chapter 55. I slam around the barracks, furious with myself. I'm a tightly stretched rubber band of built-up energy, ready to snap. I pace the linoleum floor, berating myself for being the girl that every lame teacher, including the one, pegged me to be. A dropout. If there's one thing in my life I needed to finish, it was this. I had him, right in front of me, right where I wanted him. My chance! And what did I do? I studied my feet. Some child of the prophecy I've turned out to be. I'm on the verge of catching fire. I can feel it. And to release the anger, I whip around, kick one of the solid wood bunks and crumple onto the floor, swallowing a scream of pain. This just keeps getting better, doesn't it? I roll onto my side, wincing, and take slow, calming breaths. The one's face appears before me, and fear falls away from me like water. I see through his mask, through to the dentures and the color contacts, see that it is just a human face, aging and powerless to stop time. A tiny, insignificant blot on humanity who will wither and die without my power. My M. Something I'll never give up. I put my hands on the sides of his face, almost tenderly, and terror flickers in his eyes. He sees the change in me, the control. A flash of energy illuminates the whole room. I laser in on his thoughts, but I don't even need to waste energy warping them. He knows I've won, that there is no greater sorceress in existence, that to live, he must fix his misdeeds. His head falls into his hands, shame overwhelming him. He even cries. "Can we ever forgive him?" he asks. All he needed was a bit of coaxing, and now things can go back to the way they were before. A sob cuts through the fantasy, and I blink away the image of the defeated one. Another cry pierces the air, that hopeless, scared shriek of a child who's lost all hope. I scramble to my feet, wincing from my wounded toe, and peer outside the barred windows of the barracks at the commotion in the courtyard below. My view is slightly obscured by a watchtower, but I can still see him. Pierce. I grip the bars with white knuckles, seething with white-hot rage. The nauseating serpent towers over a small boy and holds a book by its spine in disgust. The kid looks at the ground, obviously expecting the worst, and the rest of the children are gathered, wide-eyed and frozen, much like they were when he entered the barracks the other day. Pity tugs at my heart. Can I honestly blame these NO youth for their evil acts, for following the one's orders when the environment of terror obviously keeps them so rigidly in check? "What have we here?" Pierce says, his words clipped and cheerful but loud enough for the whole compound to hear. "New order, 1, 2, 3, the soldier's path. Interesting choice of reading material. It's a pity that all reading material for level 1 recruits is strictly banned," he says, a threat creeping into his voice.
But it's for you," the kid stutters in protest. "For you and the one. I was just studying. I just want to be the most exemplary New Order youth I can be, sir."
Pierce scoffs, pacing out of my view. "Literacy rots the brain, I'm afraid, and a rotten mind is of no use to the New Order. Sadly, there must be consequences. We'll have to demonstrate to these other rule-abiding youths the detriments of disobedience." I crane my neck through the bars, just in time to see Pierce step forward and grab the boy by his temples. "No!" I yell, fire shooting through my fingertips, but only enough to melt the bars. Pierce looks around sharply, but it's too late. The kid's eyes roll backward, and in less than a second, his face is only ash. The rest of the youth troop gasps. Clearly, these are new recruits who haven't witnessed the rampant cruelty up close before. I bet none of them will forget the lesson. Neither will I. A kid. He was just a kid. I step back from the fire-damaged window, numb. My stomach twists with the fresh realization of what the one and his despicable henchmen are capable of. It's a crushing contrast to my daydream, but it rallies my conviction at the same time. I have to deal with the one, because crimes like this, murders like this, go on day after day in this cowardly new world. And if what they say is true, if I'm the one with the gift, the one who can stop the one, who am I to go on pretending it'll get better? When kids are dying, what right do I have to be afraid? This time, I'm going out to get him. Chapter 56. I wake with a start,
a sense of urgency making my mind hum. I forgot to return the keys to the palace after cleaning the elite apartments this afternoon, and no one noticed. Around me in the barracks, my fellow NO comrades snooze in their bunks, looking impossibly innocent. It's very late, around 2 or 3 a.m., and I should probably lie back down and dream of another toilet-filled day ahead of me. Should probably get some rest before the morning punishment comes, when they realize I still have the keys. But I'm far too restless for that. My fingertips tingle. I can feel my M growing. An exhilarating energy is coursing through me, and I have to act on it. I'm finally ready to confront the one, and there's no better time than right this minute. I dress in the dark and tiptoe past the slumbering kid soldiers, sneaking out of the barracks and into the starless night. I slink along the brick buildings, pausing as still as a statue and pressing into the wall as the searchlight passes over me. There is a group of NO guards making noise in the courtyard, their good spirits and stumbles suggesting alcohol and band activity. One shoves another as I watch from the shadows, and the soldiers screech with laughter. If I'm caught on forbidden grounds, it's punishable by expulsion, and catching guards breaking rules would probably mean something a whole lot worse for me. I could kill them, I think, shocking myself with this realization that I would do anything to get to the one right now. More than that, I have the power to. But they're already distracted, and I've reached the side gate. There's no room for fear as I quietly take the palace keys from my belt loop and unlock the door, adrenaline and the daydream of defeating the one urging me forward. I pad up the stairs to the imperial suite, rehearsing over and over in my head what I'll say, how I will open the door silently and stealthily, how I won't hesitate to zap the one with a brain bolt so powerful he'll drop dead on contact. Instead, I'm totally unprepared when I reach the one's door to find him, the picture of cool nonchalance, leaning against his doorway, expecting me. He takes a small ceremonial bow, an amused smile playing across his lips, and says, "I really am proud of you and how well you do toilets, Wisteria all good. It's a step in the right direction anyway. So is that new order uniform. It looks stunning on you, truly." "But," I falter, "you mean, you knew it was me?" The one sneers and manages to look both furious and amused at once. "Of course I knew it was you. I didn't want to push you if you weren't ready to join me quite yet." He studies his creepily long, manicured nails absently. "I wasn't willing to wait much longer, and I'm delighted you sought me out at last. So are you now ready to join me, Wisteria?"
Chapter 57. My eyes are shut tight against the grisly horrors about to take place, but when the Lost One's fierce chanting stops suddenly, I force them open. Sasha and Emmett are gaping at something in the distance, and I follow their gaze with a mix of hope and fear. What I see takes my breath away. An extraordinary light grows on the horizon, breaking through the bleak fog. I squint against the bright radiance, and it's Celia in all her glory, racing toward us from over the hills with an army of half-lights in her wake. There is a long, silent moment when the Lost Ones freeze in place, their faces distorted with distress. Not a soul moves, as the light pulses onward. And then, all hell breaks loose. The Lost Ones stumble forward, dazed, pulled toward this age-old enemy as moths to flame. The half-lights surge to meet them, and the forces of light and dark collide in one blinding, writhing mass. An explosion of energy bursts forth, like a sun re-emerging after an eclipse, too painful to look at directly. It's over in an instant. Then the Lost Ones tear off, frantic and screeching, and beat a path of destruction through the bone forest. Defeated. The half-lights take the camp and get to work untying the kids from the stakes and putting out the raging fires. Sasha is already singing songs of victory and gathering together the saved resistance, but I can see that his cheeks are wet with tears. And Celia, my Celia, races to my side, her deft fingers flitting over my body though I can't quite feel them, undoing the straps and releasing the levers. She's still a half-light, not quite solid, but in the Shadowland, it seems, her touch has more weight. She can move these objects constructed by other creatures of the underworld.
Seals, how did you... Why did they...
I'm babbling with relief, unable to get a coherent word out.
The balance has shifted, she murmurs,
still working, her mouth twisting in concentration. She looks up at me. In the Shadowland, what's good becomes more pure over time, and what's bad just rots with its evil. So, you're at your strongest when they're at their weakest?
Celia nods.
When we're all together like this, she gestures at the half-lights, the light wins. Soon I'm standing face to face with her, and I feel whole again. And I've finally put something together.
It was you before, wasn't it?
When our parents were executed, and Wisty and I were supposed to go down with them. There was that blinding, painful light, and the one was on his knees screaming. Wisty and I fell, like falling into death, only light caught us.
It was you. You and the other half-lights.
Sort of. It was a little more complicated than that, but it doesn't matter now. She puts her hand on my lips and smiles that gorgeous, sweet smile that lights up her whole face.
I mean, aren't you gonna say it's good to see me?
I look into her teasing eyes, put my hands around her face. Celia, it is so, so good to see you. I'm melting into her eyes.
I'm sorry I had to abandon you earlier, Wit.
Forget it. I know there's a reason for everything in this insane world, even if I don't understand it. All that matters is that I'm
feeling you again.
Sasha comes up behind me and yells, "Aww," in his sappiest, most obnoxious voice. He jabs me in the ribs. Emmett joins us, looking embarrassed, but wiggles his eyebrows approvingly anyway. Janine appears behind them, smiling, but not with her eyes. I look around at the camp, the bonfire remnants and animal bones and menacing forest beyond. The scene still appears eerie in the red mist of the underworld sky, but the glow from all of the half-lights moving around and making sure the kids are all right makes everything seem almost safe. Like finding out the monster in the room is just your imagination when you switch on the light. Almost like we're not in the land of the dead. Chapter 58. Under the pretense of scouting out a trail, Celia and I walk hand in hand away from the group. With her next to me now, I can almost forget about finding my parents, about Wisty risking her life to take down the one, about nearly being roasted alive, about Janine. I can convince myself that there's just us, two carefree teenagers in love, walking into the wilderness. We stop at the edge of the forest, and Celia peers up at me, her eyes swimming.
There's so much I have to tell her, but she's looking at me like she already knows everything I'm feeling, everything I've been through. So for now, I just want to savor this moment.
Celia lifts her chin up, and I inhale her scent, dizzy with love and need. I put my lips against hers so tenderly, but I can't feel her at all. She's only air. And then Celia leans into me, and we do something I've been thinking about, dreaming about, since the last time I saw her. We merge into one soul, one being. And it takes my breath away. I've never felt so close to anyone, so whole. And it's as if my heart is expanding and being crushed at once. I feel her everywhere. Chapter 59. I want to stay like this forever, enveloped in Celia's warmth and safe in her cocoon of light. But it's only a few seconds before I feel her slipping away from me again, our cells realigning in our separate bodies.
Oh man, that's just incredible.
I breathe into Celia's wild hair as we finally break apart. Best thing ever,
she agrees. The living are really missing out. She laughs, but then catches herself. It's less funny when she remembers which side of the divide I'm on. Do you think maybe... Her eyes search mine, uncertain. Don't you think it might be time to move on? Where are we moving on to? I ask, trying to keep the hurt out of my voice. Celia, you can't leave here, right? I don't want to go back again without you. I want to be with you. Forever. As I say it, I notice Janine watching us walking back, her jaw set and eyes clear with understanding. Celia tenses and intertwines her fingers with mine. She doesn't say anything for a moment, and I know she's considering the possibilities. I squeeze her hand as best I can, but then she breaks away and turns on me.
Don't you think I want that too? It's not something I can just decide, Whit. You can't survive here.
But you can destroy the Lost Ones, right? I plead. We can live here safely, together. Celia shakes her head.
That's not how it works, baby. Without their darkness, the Shadowland is out of balance. The good doesn't come without the bad. All of it passes through here. Without them, the passages between worlds begin to close. They're already closing.
Seals, you're not making any sense, I swear.
Think of it like this, Whit. We need them to continue to exist, so that our light doesn't go out completely.
My breath catches.
It'll never go out, Celia, I choke.
I couldn't bear it. She smiles, but it's a sad smile filled with longing and untold secrets.
We'll deal with that when the time comes, she whispers. But right now, there are things you need to see in the Shadowland.
Things all of you need to see, she says, as we approach the group of resistance kids. The others can come too. You too, Janine, she adds as an afterthought. Janine nods and looks away, and my ears heat up in shame. I want to take her hand to explain, but I can't.
Chapter 60. I walk toward him, head held high, and for a moment time stops as the one and I take in each other, the disheveled, determined girl and the demonic dictator towering over her. The fluorescent light flickers, casting gray-green shadows on his face. He looks garish, possessed, evil. My confidence is zapped by his cold, cruel stare. I can't do this. I step back from him, muscles twitching like a deer ready to bolt. I turn, but the one grabs my wrist, lightning quick, nearly snapping the bones. Time's up, child. I'm giving you the choice, the opportunity of an apprenticeship. He twists my arm, his grasp fierce and unsparing. Say you'll take it, Wisteria. I'm losing. Ah! I grimace in pain. Patience! I swallow hard, concentrating all of my focus on the fantasy, the one where I'm able to strip the one completely of his power. It felt so real, so attainable earlier. I have the gift, right? I'm the chosen one. So why do I feel so small? Why do I feel myself shrinking from him, ready to forfeit? And then, in a flash, I see that kid's skin peel back from his head. I look at the cold glee on the one's angular face, drunk with power, and I realize that there's no time to hesitate, that it has to happen now. The fire is building within me, ready to spark, and I laser in on him just like in the daydream. I distill every ounce of M I've been saving up, and I release it on this pathetic tyrant. The one's eyes widen as he looks down at my arm, flames licking through his grip. The heat is there, the fire, but it's more than that. It's control. He makes a choking sound, and I feel the raw electric power pulse from my fingertips and connect with him. The one flies backward, crashing against the wall. He hovers several feet off the ground, clenching his manicured fingers and writhing in real pain. It's awful to watch, and I want to stop, to back off. I'm not connecting with his thoughts. Can't remember how. But I can't look away. This is what I came here to do. I send one final surge and his limbs convulse as if zapped by a bolt of lightning, and he collapses in a heap on the hallway floor. I'm too scared to move, too spent by this power to see what I've done. I don't know what I'm capable of. Could he be dead? But as soon as the thought crosses my mind, the one springs back up, his eyes insanely bright, and laughs weakly, the skin stretched tight across his stiff jaw, a puppet of horror. You're doing it all wrong, Wistie. Backward. Oh, how it pains me. Then, as if he's decided to relieve me of a great burden, it appears that I am the only one who has any idea how to properly exercise your power. I can hardly bear the injustice of it. But perhaps we can strike a deal, he offers with fake benevolence. I want to show you something. I want you to see my secret. I want to share. Chapter 61. The one escorts me into his private quarters, through the entryway I recognize from earlier. He slams the door shut, and I flinch, claustrophobic with the sense that I may never get out of here. I glance at the desk across the room, remembering the private, sensitive documents in there, and suddenly feel cold down to my bones, as if I've stepped into a walk-in refrigerator. Does he know? He guides me across the room, maneuvering me with his hand on the small of my back, and I feel sick. I had him, but curiosity got the better of me, and now I've let down my guard. I train my eyes straight ahead, looking at the unadorned walls, the small main room, unsure of what he has planned. There's more to this place than I thought. He leads me to the far side of the room, to a spot in the wall that is slightly inconsistent, and I raise an eyebrow quizzically. But the one doesn't say a word. He lifts a hand, and a door flies open. And I'm totally weirded out by what lies behind it. It's a seemingly endless hall of mirrors, and the one urges me forward, placing me in the middle to confront my own reflection. I half expect the mirrors to shatter at once, glass raining down on me in a dramatic finish. But all is still. I peer into the mirrors, my image echoing into infinity, an army of Wisties looking small and scared and lost, just like I did in his bathroom, looking weak. Then I remember the things I found there, the exposed vulnerability, and I set my jaw, determined not to let him get to me. And when I change my expression, something happens. A thousand Wisties mime this change back at me and stand there looking strong, confident, and so, so powerful. I feel the magic coursing through me, feel the truth of the prophecies, and I know. I could rule this whole universe if I wanted to. It could all be mine. I shudder, feeling lightheaded. You see, the one whispers from behind me like a patient teacher coddling a wayward student. It's not about you, Wisteria, and it's certainly not about us or we. It's about me. It's about I, the most powerful creative force, and the most dangerous is the human ego. Now do you understand? Yes. I do understand. Everything Mrs. Highsmith was trying to tell us about power and playing God comes into acute focus. The important thing isn't about using the gift. It's about not using it, about keeping others from getting a hold of it. Each one of us possesses that unique human narcissism, that self-importance that can spin wildly out of control. And the key to survival, to all of human survival, is keeping it under wraps. Power corrupts, I whisper. Always remember. I understand the enemy now. It's not just him, the one. It's I, me, ego. And I can't let that take over like this evil man has. Chapter 62. Since we're talking about ego, I mutter to myself. I turn to the one, keeping my eyes trained on his face and away from these warped mirrors. I understand now, I say. But before I join you, I want to know more about who you are, how you got here. I think back to the science award, the harsh teacher's note that I found earlier. Tools to get at him, to make him vulnerable. Tell me how you got to be so... I swallow. Say it like you mean it, Whist. Great. The one stands up a little straighter. Flattery suits him.
Why, Wisteria? I told you I'd tell you anything. You just had to ask. It's only natural you should want to know how one could possibly achieve all that I have, that you should covet that power.
His eyes flash at me, testing, but I nod at him as sincerely as I can manage, and he continues.
Once upon a time, a small boy was different. No, not just different. Brilliant.
He's speaking loudly now, as if performing for an audience, and his voice echoes through the tunnel of mirrors.
Those in a position of authority discouraged his immense talents, labeling him hoodlum, ruffian, young terrorist.
The one's eyes glaze over as he recalls the memory.
Indeed, their assessment was astute on that account, for they would definitely endure terror, he mutters, then raises his voice. Instead of helping him, encouraging him, they accused him of lies.
Disturbing demonstrations? I say, before I can stop myself, recalling the paper I found in the desk. But the one doesn't seem to make the connection. Instead, he nods, looking at me intently.
Sound familiar? You and I are the same, Wisteria.
Is there any truth to that? I think back to my days of skipping school, of the disappointed looks around the dinner table, of everyone expecting me to fail because of the way I dressed, or because I was smart in a different way than the other kids. It hurt. Still, that didn't make me take a hatchet to the whole world, did it? In what way are we the same? Anger creeps into my voice. I could never do what you do. I look away from the one but only see his image reflected all around, and he takes a step closer, looming over me, his voice vibrating in my ears.
Teachers, principals, your parents, they failed you. They never loved you, never appreciated the talent you possessed, never helped you hone it, grow it. Instead, they wanted to squash it, kill it, to destroy you.
I think of my mom threading her fingers through my hair, my dad rocking out with me to a song on the radio, giving me a hard time about grades, but giving me the space to be creative, loving me, letting me be a kid instead of a prophet, trying to protect me from this life of greed. How did the one get all of his power?
Ego, persuasion, indoctrination, and a serious grudge against humanity.
No, I shake my head, steeling my mind against the one's brainwashing.
It's you who's been trying to destroy me. You!
Can't you see, child?
He asks, his voice dripping with false tenderness.
I've only wanted to be a good father to you, to give you the encouragement I never had. I'm inviting you to sit beside me. Everything I have.
He stretches his arms wide, and 1,000 mirrored arms seem to reach for me, closing in.
Could all be yours. I've only been trying to help the world, Wisty, to make them see. We only have to cleanse it of the useless and the pitiful, and then we can start anew. Come, I'll show you what you could have.
I can't even respond to that. One minute he's talking about trying to help the world, and in the same breath he proposes genocidal cleansing? What a sociopath. Still, as the one walks to the end of the hallway, his thin frame guiding me along the mirrors, I follow. I'm in too deep to turn back now. I realize I'm holding my breath, and when he turns the doorknob and presses forward, the hallway fills with warm, dazzling light. And when I see what's inside that room, my head nearly explodes. Chapter 63. "No way," I whisper. My eyes bug out of my head, and I'm so dazed you could knock me over with a breath, even if you weren't the one. Somehow, in this brick-and-mortar palace, lies a door to a room that is infinite. It's bigger than a ballroom, a football field, a mall. I cannot see the far end, and as I press my hand against the golden walls to test if they're real, they are. My synapses are overloaded, and my brain can process only one thought. Beauty. On the walls and the floor, stacked in piles and leaning against corners, is everything that's been taken away from us. I stumble forward, breathlessly trailing my fingers against harps, guitars, centuries-old paintings by true masters. Light seems to emanate from these objects, drawing me in. All the greatest art, the greatest books, the greatest films, the greatest music is right here. Every last thing. Well, almost. The collection we saw in Mrs. Highsmith's apartment was just a tiny fraction of what's in this room. It must have been what she hid from him, what she salvaged. She needed to save it for the rest of the world when the iron grip of the new order had eased. The one steps beside me and puts his hand on my shoulder, interrupting my thoughts.
"This is the good life, child, the only life worth living."
He turns me toward him, holds my face in his hands, his thumbs pressing into my forehead, and I flinch.
"You are superior. You should live a superior life. Look what you can share with me."
My eyes flit to the stacks of music, the amplifiers, the sleekest guitar I've ever seen. His thumbs press harder, and his eyes are wild, desperate.
"Just give me your gift. Give it to me."
Chapter 64. As his technicolor eyes bore into mine, I finally see what he's capable of. It'll never end. It'll never be enough. One man's ego will leech all the life, all the beauty from the whole world. I think of all he's promised me, every lie, but my mind latches on to one statement made at his weakest moment. "You're doing it all wrong, Wisty." "Backward," he had said before, when I tried to pulverize him. What did he mean?
"Give it to me!"
he shrieks over and over, pressing, pressing. I try to twist away, but he clenches my temples even harder. I'd do anything to make him stop. And then I understand. If I can control electrical impulses of the brain, can I just stop them too? Can I shut them down? Can I kill someone just by concentrating on it? Mrs. Highsmith said in no uncertain terms that I had to deal with the one. "Murder," she meant. A horrible, stifling guilt chokes me. But in that second, with the one's psychopathic eyes trained on me, I feel a lightning bolt strike between us. It lifts my feet right off the ground. I don't know how I got here, or what to do, but I don't know how to stop it either. "No, Wisteria," he gasps. "Not like that." His grip slides off and he collapses to the floor. Panicked, I stand looking at his unconscious face, the white noise deafening in my ears. I kneel down and slowly put my head on his chest, listening. I'm shaking. I'm shaking and emotional and volatile, and I feel that familiar heat starting in my fingers. I stand up abruptly. I can't be here. Taking one last look around this paradise, I run past the artwork, past the guitars and sculptures with missing arms and noses. The girl on fire, racing down the long, accusing hallway of mirrors. Chapter 65. I don't know where I'm going, and I'm sobbing so hard I can barely see. I tear through the hall, down the stairs, into another hall of suites, not even feeling my legs carrying me. And then I'm hit by a bus. Well, that's what it feels like anyway. Pierce has tackled me and rolled on top of me, and I hate myself for always finding him so attractive when I first see him. Luckily, every word that Pierce utters and every kid he tortures overrides that hormonal response to his bone structure pretty quickly. "Is he dead?" Pierce shouts over me, eyes blazing. I stare into his face, unsure if he's hoping more for a yes or a no. He shakes my shoulders, slamming me into the floor. "Tell me, witch, is he?" "No," I yell back. "He's alive, he's still alive." I note his use of the word witch. "So you know that I'm..." Pierce laughs like I'm the stupidest person in the overworld. "Ah, yes, the infamous Wisteria Allgood. Wanted fugitive." He grips my hair and I turn away from his touch. "Even without your precious red hair, I was on to you. That's the weakest attempt at a disguise I've ever seen. I should have killed you when I had the chance. Should have slaughtered you like a pig on that filthy floor." "Why didn't you?" I challenge, fury building at remembering my humiliation in the barracks. "You were afraid of me. Admit it." "I didn't think you were worth it. But don't worry." His face is inches from mine, and his words drip with hatred. "I won't miss my chance this time. Believe me when I say that I want you dead even more than the one wants your gift." "The feeling is mutual, Pierce," I say, and he smirks. "Glad we got to have a little foreplay first, though. Did it turn you on, Miss Allgood? Did you find it hot?" "That wasn't my idea of hot, but this is." Flames erupt from my body as if I'm doused in gasoline. I burn brightly, consumed with fury for this waste of a human being. I shove him off me and scramble to hold him down, my fire licking at his face. He doesn't seem to be burning. He's not even sweating. I press in and Pierce rolls away, leaping up. I scramble after him to try to fight, but he's physically stronger than I am and he snatches my arm away. And in that stunned moment, I realize my fire is having absolutely no effect. He's immune. He lunges in and grips my forehead, ready to melt my skull. The brief second of contact is all I need. Energy explodes between us, and I can instantly feel Pierce's synapses begin to shut down. His eyes roll back into his head, and foam starts to form at his mouth. I'm killing him. Tears rush down my cheeks. He's evil, I remind myself. He's a sadist who wants you dead. The door to the exit stairwell slams open, and as if is in slow motion, I watch Byron running down the hall, his mouth frozen in one long O. Pierce's hand is still on my head. Byron has seen him liquefy 100 kids' faces. He thinks Pierce is killing me. I put my hand up to flag him, but it's too late. Byron crashes into Pierce and the connection is lost. I snap out of my trance and rush over to Byron. He's still shouting furiously, and he doesn't let Pierce up like I expect him to. Instead, he punches him in the face over and over. I touch his shoulder and his fist stops in midair. It's over, B! He's not getting up for a while. He looks at me, confused and emotional, like a little kid. He peers at his bloody fingers and doesn't seem to understand how they got that way. Come on, I say gently. We have to go. He nods and we take off again, leaving Pierce bruised but breathing, slumped in a corner. I'm sorry, Whist, Byron says when we're beyond the compound. I didn't understand what you were doing, that you were... He looks away, swallowing. Going to kill him. He takes my hand. I wouldn't have stopped you if I knew. I shake my head. I don't know if I could have finished it anyway. But we're in serious trouble now, regardless. Byron raises an eyebrow, questioning. Remember what happened at the music festival when I directed my energy through you? He nods. He'll never forget that. Well, I think I just made Pierce a whole lot stronger.
Chapter 66. We run through the bone forest in single file, and even Pfeffer doesn't whine or make a sound. Celia swears the river can't be far, but as the air gets thinner and harder to breathe, I'm not sure we'll make it. Skeletons creak all around us, and arms seemingly come to life and reach for our bodies, wanting to absorb our life. Even the trees are instruments of death. There is sweat on my brow. I think I'm running a fever. My breath comes in short sips, and I can feel the magic seeping right out of me, draining my body. Suddenly there's a spark flying off my fingertip, like I'm about to short-circuit or something. It's almost like my power is reacting to other forces here, all buzzing in this spot somehow, like too many wires plugged into one outlet. The Shadowland seems to spiral as I hallucinate. I think I see a man's face in my vibrating vision, a face with sharp, jutting cheekbones and cruel eyes, almost like the ones, but older, warped. But when I blink, it's only a tree skull, laughing at me. I'm losing my mind. As if sensing my weakness, one of the younger resistance kids catches up to me at the front, his skin sallow and his eyes ringed with dark circles. He's around 12 and has two even smaller children in tow.
We're dying, aren't we?
The older kid looks at me with frank accusation, and I must seem bewildered. The Shadowland is where the dead go, so we're about to die. I close my eyes and try to get my composure together enough to reassure this kid, beaten by the world but surviving, and am unsure of what to say, how to tell him we'll get out of here, when I don't know for sure.
What's your name, kid?
Reagan, he says, gruffly, a tuft of sandy blonde hair falling in his eyes.
Bennett Reagan.
We're not dying, Reagan. Yet, at least. The air here is just making us weak.
Listen, I've been taking care of these two for a long time, he says, scowling.
He grips the younger boy's hands in his.
I just want you guys to be honest with me.
As we near the edge of the forest, I'm feeling stronger again, less drugged, more optimistic. I put my hand on his shoulder. I promise, if things get really bad, I'll give you a heads up. Reagan nods, looking skeptical, and shuffles back to the end of the line. As light finally breaks through the trees of the bone forest, we stumble out onto a barren, rocky landscape with steep cliffs. We come to a clearing, a hilltop on the lip of what looks like a huge basin. What I see inside it sweeps my breath away for a moment. In the valley below, there are thousands of people, some flickering in and out of view, some with a dull half-glow like Celia's. Every single one of them is dead.
This is the end of the world, Whit, Celia says. I mean that literally. Your world ends right here. There, another world begins.
I start to race down the slope. If we're this close to so many dead people, the river can't be far. And neither can my parents. The rest of the resistance follows me, rushing through the eerily lush green field toward our salvation.
Wait! Celia shouts, her voice trembling. Not that way!
She turns and points at the path behind us.
They're coming, she whispers.
And then I see them, tearing over the hillside, teeth bared. Not dogs, exactly, or even wolves. Beasts. Spirit suckers, non-human lost ones. Flesh-eating fiends with the body of a beast and the mind of a demon. I turn to Reagan.
I promised you I'd tell you if it was bad.
Well, we're there.
It's really, really bad. Run!
But there's no time. They're already upon us. Celia crashes into two of them, her bright light exploding against their evil. But though she's unharmed, they aren't afraid of her. They plow through her like air, and one seizes a kid from behind, snarling and thrashing. Celia is pleading in anguish, clawing at the animal's rank, rotting fur from behind. But she's too late. A scream rips through the air, and I whip around to see a wolf tearing into Janine's shoulder. I run for her, but Pfeffer beats me there, lunging at the creature and distracting it from its feast. Pfeffer is no match for the beast, and she yips in pain as the soul sucker bites at her legs and locks its jaw in her throat. Wisty loved that dog. I grab the closest object I can find, a bone, and rush toward them, arms raised. I strike a blow at the soul sucker and it releases Pfeffer, lurching instead for me, its yellow eyes cold and calculating. It snaps at me with those long jaws, rows of teeth glistening, but I show no mercy, bashing the monster again and again as it roars at me furiously, until finally it collapses.